do is try to apply to the state set aside, and they gave me this gentleman's name, Jim Cooper, who I've emailed multiple times. I left a message. Steve Rusk has emailed and asked him, and he hasn't responded to either one of us. So I don't know if the possibility of funding is zero, or if we can, I don't know if it would be $10,000 or if we could get up to $100,000. So I asked Rebecca, and I'm asking the board to just hold off on the, she said, well, we can just take the percentages that were already set and apply that to whatever funding we receive. But I said, if we receive $20,000, it wouldn't make sense to divvy it up into 30%, 30%, 30%. So if we can receive any funding through the state set aside, then I will find out how much and present that to the board for your decision on funding. And hopefully this is just a weird glitch this year, or the numbers. Well, the good news is we don't qualify for funding. I mean, but we likely will in future years, so I'll keep you updated.
Well, the important thing to know with this funding is that it's FEMA dollars, and it's really for emergency situations. And what they really, you know, want to make clear is that it's not guaranteed from year to year. We've been really fortunate to have gotten it for a very long time. And so we as a community have come to rely upon it. But the fact is we're not in a state of emergency that FEMA has determined would make a community eligible for these funds. Portland also didn't receive funds a few years ago, but now is back into a position where they did receive funds. And so it doesn't mean that we won't receive funds in the future. It just simply means this year we're not in that state of emergency as determined by FEMA, and so we won't be receiving funds.
So what?
How is that possible? Portland's unemployment rate is in the fives. How the heck?
So they look at, I mean, it's Multnomah County, so I don't know, based on Portland versus
Oregon's, I mean,
I'm not sure that I fully believe their numbers, but they're from the Department of Labor, so.
And it's got, I mean, so.
The other thing, oh, sorry.
If we're able to get to this Jim Cooper guy, is Scott, did Scott say, hey, Scott Bailey say, hey, I'll go and check that poverty rate for you? Did he say he'd give us any fault? Because if we get to Jim Cooper, making sure our numbers are strong when we go to Jim Cooper is going to be important.
So what he said is, it really doesn't look right to me. I'm sure it's not correct, but those are what, I mean, it's a national reporting. He's not, we can make the case to Jim Cooper, but and it will help support our case, but we're not going to get the formula changed.
I understand, but as we go to Jim Cooper, mm-hmm. making sure our case is as strong as
definitely.
Possible to him.
And in regards to the Portland unemployment, you only have to meet two of the three.
So
we didn't meet two of them.
So ultimately, how's that going to affect our food and our shelter programs? Do we have any idea yet?
Well, we've notified the providers, and I can get you the spreadsheet of what they were planned to receive, but it's not huge amounts.
Okay.
It will obviously make an impact.
It'll make an impact, but it's not shutting anyone down and making people go hungry.
So on this chart, for example, that Ms. Hugh were doing later, that money is currently in the...
That's a completely separate program that's not recorded there. We don't actually contract these dollars, so it's a little bit different, but the board still sets the priorities for us.
So I have a question. For the FEMA's formula, did these percentages, have they changed recently for this year, the 307.6, 17.6, or were these percentages the same last year as well? Did they go up and maybe we didn't meet the threshold? Because they went up? Did our numbers go down?
Yeah, I can find that out. I'm not sure if they update them year to year or if they just have their set number and then jurisdictions fall where they may. I would think, do you know, Kate?
My understanding is that they look at it on an annual basis. And so presumably, and I've not verified this, the numbers had gone, so with the unemployment rate, it would have gone down. And with the poverty rate, it also would have gone down.
Our poverty rate for phase 33, but I mean for the formula rates.
That's a good question. I don't know.
I'm really surprised that you have to have a minimum of 300 persons unemployed. That seems so low almost
yeah.
a given, unhelpful, yeah.
Okay, so we need a decision on that at this point from the board to just hold off. So we'll just let that go for now.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to run out on you, but I have another meeting that I'm supposed to be at. So
I understand completely.
Any questions, Rebecca can field in, and I'll look into whatever information you need.
Great, post it. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, so then, Ty, it looks like you and I might be the only folks here that, well, attended the CSBG symposium and the Ending Homelessness Conference. Kate was very involved. A lot of other people went to the Ending Homelessness Conference, but both of us went to the symposium. Do you have any feedback you'd like to share?
What was the symposium? Where was it?
In Portland.
The DoubleTree.
The DoubleTree.
I don't.
Oh, yeah. There was something I went to. No, DoubleTree. I didn't go to that.
I don't. Yeah, I don't go to.
I've been to the.
I was
no.
there.
I was at an FBLA conference at the DoubleTree.
Well, you can report on that. Anyone want to share anything from the Ending Homelessness Conference? Any feedback? Any review?
Oh my gosh, it's been so long now.
Right.
I'm trying to. The session I found the most impactful was. We had a long discussion about it afterwards, Michael.
Are you talking about the prevention?
Prevention, helping people, giving people the opportunity to think through, in moments of crisis, helping people think mm-hmm. about what their options are, what's available to them currently, was impactful to me. Just in crisis, people need somebody to talk.
Well, I'll also share at the symposium in Portland, and you attended that too, Michael. It was really pretty fascinating, and what I gathered from that was just how kind of out of the box some ideas are becoming, even on a larger scale in Portland. There's a builder who's building really affordable homes for people. There's also a movement in Multnomah County to build tiny houses in the backyards of some people's homes. And so there's some really innovative ideas that are really starting to take hold. And so that was pretty inspiring to me, too. Did you have anything else to add?
To me, the most impactful thing was the... there was a luncheon presentation by a gentleman who really went down on breaking out the ability of the government to impact poverty, and had used the actions of the Great Depression and Social Security and these programs, and just statistically showed the data on what change there was on the incidence of poverty in the population in general, and especially in the senior population, as those programs took hold. And then linked existing poverty with employment, and spoke about the availability of jobs, and how that we could fill every single job, there would still be this, we wouldn't solve poverty. This the importance of living wage job to actual poverty, and then laid out some policy changes that could happen that would also be impactful in that. So it wasn't really in the human service, social service realm, but in that. And in terms of the conference, the things I attended, and the themes I saw in the conference, I saw a lot about awareness and how do we better serve underrepresented and groups, underrepresented, underserved groups in system problems, you know, like in race, class, and what those effects are in homelessness, and then how can you improve shelter, improve access to housing, you know, with awareness of where these problems are. So, you know, those were themes that I saw that were good, thought-provoking themes. So,
you said you laid out some potential policy.
Oh yeah, but I can't remember what they were. I just remember the problems.
Are you talking about, I forget his name, from the Federal Reserve?
No, I was talking about, he was a think tank guy. I don't think I have those notes in this notebook. I don't.
It's interesting too, though, that we can learn about things really from the policy side of it and how those policies really affect all the social services and the things that we're doing, because we're so used to dealing with the social service side of it, that I think it's good for us to learn about how it can affect things from the top down, you know?
Yeah, that's
it. I'll just continue with the themes that a few others that I definitely felt like I heard was around making sure that all programs, regardless of whether they're housing or it's outreach or it's a day center, that it's focused on housing stability.
Yes.
And making sure that people are moving toward stable housing, and focusing on reducing their barriers, as well as you know, looking to make sure that whatever type of program is being done, that it be based on best practice, and that you really look at the fidelity models and work to move your programs in that direction. And I'm certainly pleased, you know, we can talk about how we're imparting that into our specific programs, but that's key, and even on a national basis, the programs that have really gotten to that true fidelity of evidence-based practices have been very successful, from housing first to rapid rehousing to even emergency shelter. And so, you know, there's always work that can be done, but the outcomes are very strong for those that are focused on evidence-based practices. And then I'll also share, I went to the Medicaid symposium the day before the conference, and the focus there was on the fact that the state has submitted an 1115 waiver to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. And among many kind of proposals that have been submitted, the one that is most key for the housing and homeless providers is the ability for housing providers to bill Medicare for supportive services. It's key if that billing is going to happen, that the individuals either be chronically homeless, that they be extraordinarily vulnerable, or that they be high utilizers of various systems of care within the state. There's many details that need to be worked out, but the state is very optimistic that this waiver will go through, as long as it happens by, I think I heard September, is that when it needs to happen? By September, then we'll be able to move forward. So we're looking forward to that. There's many unanswered questions, millions of details that need to be worked out, but the biggest strength to the homeless systems is that it's another source of funding that will support our system, and it will help us move some of the supportive service dollars that are currently going toward housing first programs to, you know, being able to provide additional housing or build additional housing or what have you. So it just increases the overall capacity of the system, which is a strength.
1 second.
Excellent. Hey, any other
questions? Okay, great. So Judith is now on the line. Welcome, Judith.
Hi, Judith.
I wanted to say that right now, Judith, we're talking about the feedback for the CSBG symposium and the ending homelessness conference. And did you have any feedback that you'd like to share about the symposium?
Well, I thought it was really great, and I thought that what it had was a wide variety of lectures, so that it wasn't just, you know, poverty, it was also how to help people buy homes, how to have more affordable housing. It was many varieties of things. So
I agree. I think that's one of the strengths of our community services block grant funds, is the flexibility that we have with using those funds, so that we can use them in so many different ways.
Yes. It's a multifaceted problem, and so they have a multifaceted solution.
I also wanted to say when I attended the Ending Homelessness Conference, one of the big takeaways that I took was this focus on everyone being employed, and it didn't matter what your circumstances are, that even if you're in permanent supportive housing, employment is still a very important aspect of your life. It gives you a reason to get up and to do something,
right.
You know, even if it's
right.
2 hours a week, it's something that you can look forward to. And so that was really interesting to really wrap my head around, and making sure that when we're looking at our employment programs, and specifically our supported employment programs, that we make sure that they are reaching out to our permanent supported housing programs, such as Lincoln Place, where Columbia River is reaching out and making those connections, but to help, you know, not just those that are employable as we think of it, but those that everybody has that chance and should have that opportunity for employment.
Right, and it did make me think about what they mentioned at the other meeting about, you know, helping homeless people access the transportation issue. If you have a family, and it's kind of a multi-faceted approach that they talked about, you know, and that there's no, well, you all know that there's no easy answers, but that making sure the transportation issues in place for employment or for any kind of thing, being on a bus line, all of those.
Excellent. Any other discussion about any of the conferences that we've attended recently? I think it's great that there's a really holistic attitude.
It's a little echoey, so I have to concentrate when I hear you. It's a little hard to hear.
Okay, we'll do our best. Ty, did you have
something? So I'm going to, you brought up tiny homes, and I'll just share with you that a group of us met about a month ago. People who are interested in the tiny home movement, and so we've got a couple groups starting to work, one working on advocacy and education around tiny homes, and the other one working on codes and standards issues around tiny homes. And so the codes and standards group is pulling together a proposal that they're going to sit down with the city of Vancouver with the planning department and try and work through those issues. You may have, if you got down to the Recycled Arts Fair, you saw Wolf Industries had a tiny home there. So that gentleman, Derek Hugo, actually is in the process of buying a piece of property in just north of Fourth Plain, owned by the Building Industry Association, and looking at putting in a village of tiny homes back in there. So, and then there's, you know, you've probably been exposed to Michael, I can't remember that one's last name, who's doing
the veterans
group, and they've got a piece of property up on St. John's. So there's several of these tiny home things that we're trying to get going here in Vancouver as well.
So it's also come up at the county a lot, and it seems like this is one of those issues where we could have some city-county collaboration around these groups, because the guy from, what is it, Wolf
Industries.
He's been working with the county planning department around what variations there need to be in zoning. And I think the conversation gets mixed up because people are talking about two different things. And one is a solution to the shortage of low-cost housing. Mm-hmm. And the other is this niche market of, you know, people who've still got the money, but that's a chosen lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So sometimes varying the code to help, and homelessness ends up varying the code for, you know, the kind of back growth management and that sort of thing. But it does sound like we've got groups that, because the county board of the council is really want to change the rules or ease the process.
So the city is definitely looking at it holistically. So
three
different classes. Two classifications with one of them having two subclassifications. So you have ADUs, accessory dwelling units, and how do we enable those to happen in a more affordable fashion?
Right.
So we'll be looking at parking requirements and separate sewer and electrical requirements for those dwellings, but then also looking at and then the housing type, so stick built being built on site versus more of a manufactured, and even within the manufactured you have things that get plopped down versus things that get wheeled in. So the city's trying to holistically look at it, and it may be one where the city can hopefully move faster and then prove a model out to the county.
Well, I just think that the county should be part of that. And I know they've been on a segregation initiative the last 5 years or so, but this is the sort of thing where you could make it simpler and capitalize on all the good ideas that are happening.
Well, and I can at least share that there's definitely discussions. I was a part of that effort, that main Saturday meeting and the future meetings, and then have been talking to planning at the county level, trying to keep them abreast of what's going on. And the fortunate thing is that with the city, they have the opportunity to be the forerunner and make some of those mistakes and recognize, you know, how to alleviate those challenges. And I think the county can take a look at that and then move forward with, you know, through their successes. So I think it's kind of a watch and wait approach at this point. But I agree with you. The fact is there's commonality there.
It's just good to see that progress is being made and talk is happening. If it would help, I can put you in touch with the folks in Multnomah County that I connected with at the symposium.
That'd be great, but actually on this group is like the guru from Multnomah County, Ben and Cole.
Yep.
Who I'd be surprised if you were one of the speakers there, but Cole kind of guru, and he's helping kind of form the vision.
Yeah, very cool. Excellent. Okay, any other feedback about any other conferences? Very good shape. All right. Sheree, do you want to share with us a little bit about the advocacy task force?
Sure. We have been going over what is advocacy, and over also the frequently asked questions that we may have, and clarify that we belong as the CAB when advocating, and the CAB members should only speak on behalf of the entire CAB. And we also discussed about additional advocacy training, which I has been graciously offered to help us out on our meeting in November, and it'll be from 9:40 to 10:40.
Great. And just to clarify a little bit more regarding the document that's in front of you, the advocacy task force created this document in an effort to just provide more clarity around what is advocacy, what does advocacy look like. From the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance conference, they provided a great document around, you know, what does advocacy look like, and so the task force incorporated some more of those ideas, such as just voting, or, you know, more simplistic things like asking other people to vote, and so that's been incorporated into this document. On the back page, a few of the frequently asked questions from board members of later years have been asked and then answered. One in particular, I understand the last meeting there was some conversation among CAB members as to whether they can speak on behalf of the CAB, and so the clarity there is you are more than welcome when you're advocating to identify as a CAB member. The hope is that if you choose to speak on behalf of the entire CAB, that be based on CAB documents, such as like the report to the community, if that's information that you acquired from there, or information that has been adopted by the Board of County Councilors. And so your best bet when you're advocating is simply to just identify as a CAB member, and then there won't be any conflict at all there. We hope that you'll find this document as a tool, and we're also, staff is very interested in helping you gain additional information around advocating for causes that you're passionate about. And so if you feel like you're not quite sure where to start, or something is of interest or a passion to you, and you haven't quite yet connected with advocacy agencies on the state or local level, myself and Rebecca are very willing to get together with you and kind of give you a packet of information and a good place to start with some tools to move forward with, so that you can make sure that you're advocating for the causes that are most dear to your heart.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Jerry. Any discussion on this? Let's talk about it.
So I wanted to really quickly give, if I can find it, because one of the things you brought up was candidate forums, and I was looking, trying to see if I could find the dates for League of Women Voters candidate forums.
Oh, yeah. Because
they are coming up very quickly. Sorry, I'm not finding this quickly.
Okay.
So while you look, I'll ask another question. You just sent out the survey again?
Yes.
Right? I was really impressed with the document that we adopted earlier today.
The reports.
Yeah. So sharing that and posting that online, has that been done somewhere? Or should, if I do it on various groups I'm on, that's advocacy?
Absolutely, yes.
And we will share it. We don't share it until it's been formally adopted by the CAP.
Right.
So now it's been adopted, and we'll make sure that it goes out.
Yeah, that's
tomorrow.
Right. I
didn't
post it yesterday. I thought, oh no, I should wait. Okay.
Go ahead, Julie.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, regarding the survey, thank you for taking the time to fill out that survey. or when you take the time to fill out the survey. The state, Washington State Action Program, Community Action Program, they are interested in the advocacy that is happening at the local levels. And so we roll up the information you provide and then provide it to the state so that they can share it with their constituency. You are more than welcome to fill out that survey just on a quarterly basis if you keep track, or even, you know, just make a wild guess, and that's perfectly fine. Or you can fill it out every time you feel like you've done an advocacy action. You can fill it out right there throughout, you know, the days and weeks and months that you are a part of the CAB. And so, you know, whichever works best for you is perfectly fine. You know, if you feel like the survey is just a pain, you're also welcome to just email me, and I'd be glad to keep track of it for you. We just appreciate your willingness to track it and, of course, to advocate in general.
Well, one of the things that I found is how few people realize what is actually going on. And I spoke with one individual, and they cited Utah for Housing First. And I said, well, did you realize that's what we do here is Housing First? And so sometimes it's just communicating simple things that are happening within the organization as well that are helpful.
Well, I think the more that all of us advocate, the more obviously people are going to know what we're doing and what's going on.
So the first forum is tomorrow night, 6 to 9 at the library, the downtown library here. And that is 49th Legislative District and Clark Public Utilities. Second one is Thursday night in Battleground at the library. That is the 18th Legislative District, Clark County Council District number 4. The third one is July 19th at the Cascade Park Library. So, and by the way, Clark County Council District number 4 is Tom Mielke's seat. The third one is the July 19th Cascade Park Library, the 17th Legislative District, which is essentially East Vancouver, and Clark County District Number 3, which is David Medora's seat. So those are the...
Are they all 6 to 9?
They are all 6 to 9.
Excellent. Any other discussion about advocacy?
All right.
Rebecca, since Bridget isn't here, would you
Bridget's
mind...
Bridget's right here.
Oh.
Why did I not...
Because I got my levels. And I like what you were leading into.
That was great.
You
know,
we just handed off to
I that. Was quick to deflect that.
Community needs assessment.
Yeah, we had one meeting since the last one of these. And we gave Rebecca a hard time nitpicking her survey endlessly.
The board gave great feedback. They gave great feedback on
not
the survey.
Just mechanical things that probably drove her crazy. But it's looking really good, and Rebecca will outline the next steps.
So we, I incorporated as many of the, as much of that feedback as I possibly could to keep it. We wanted to make sure that we didn't expand the survey too long. It's already 6 pages. It's quite a bit of time that we're taking from people to really provide us some feedback. But we completely revamped the survey this year from what we've done in the past. So we're trying to really dig down and get better information that we can use moving forward for our next RFA. There was really great feedback on word choice and making sure that we're making it as user-friendly as possible. The survey is already up online. There was a news release that went out late last week about the survey. There, I checked yesterday, there were already 149 responses.
Wow.
Of those, one of the questions that we ask in there is if you, based on your family size, if you earn more, less than 200% of the federal poverty level, and only 18% of, oh no, I think it was 18 responses were above 100% out of that 149 that we'd already received.
That's awesome.
We just received the Spanish translations from Michael. He was fantastic, went through and did Spanish translation for us. We sent it out for Russian translation. We have those back. Those documents have been sent to our print shop. We're hoping to get them back within the next day or two. And then we will start getting them out at as many of our service provider meetings. And then we'll be mailing them to those that we don't won't see right away, or dropping them off for those agencies that are close in. So staff will be very busy over the next couple of weeks getting those surveys out to as many of our providers. I think we have over 65 programs that we're sharing the survey with, along with 19 food pantries. So we're hoping to get it out far and wide, along with having the online version.
So I'm pretty much, I'm on a lot of lists and see a lot of candy stuff. I have not seen a news release, did not know it was there. So I don't know how it's being publicized. Like, I don't see. I find sometimes people who work with the Cary website think that it's right there, when in fact you've got to be knowledgeable to dig down to the right place.
I know I've seen it. So I obviously have copied from the PIO, so I've seen that, and I forwarded that to the CAB and all of our partners, our partner list.
Did you send it to us?
It should have been sent to the CAD. If not, I will resend it.
Yeah, because I'm going to call. I don't think.
I will make sure that it goes out to you guys this afternoon. I know there was at least 75 emails, names on my email list that I sent it to. I saw it in the newspaper. And it went out on Nextdoor, and I don't know, and that's through the county service. It goes to every Nextdoor one. I don't know exactly how that works.
I did not see it on Nextdoor. I did not get an email. I did not see it on the county website. And so that may just be me, but I do spend a lot of time.
Help us. Because the fact is, if you haven't seen it, other people
haven't. We'll be sure to send it out.
Is it a different survey than, so I remember getting, and I've been on vacation, there was a link. a survey you sent and said have it filled out by 7 something.
That was,
that
the
was,
the
that was a different one.
Yes,
okay,
that one was different.
Yeah, then there wasn't an, I didn't receive another.
I will definitely send it out then. I'll, I might not have gotten it up on our website yet, but there was the article and everything else has a direct link to the survey itself rather than going through us. Makes it a little bit more efficient. But yes, I will send it out. I'll talk with the guy that's been in communication, because I've gotten some feedback through Nextdoor, through our,
yeah.
our guy. So I'll check with him to make sure that it gets out to all of the Nextdoor, because I agree, I hadn't seen it through our Nextdoor,
yeah.
our neighborhood. We live next to each other, so. and then, so then, yes, yeah, so we'll get those paper copies out to the providers, and then hopefully we continue to get good response. It's open
yes,
until the end of September, so.
End of September. Mm-hmm.
The other thing to know is that it's a rolling kind of submission out to the community.
Absolutely.
Because we have so many of the hard copies to get out to the providers, and so feel free, if you're speaking with a provider and they've not gotten the documents, email, we'll do what we can, but know that probably going to take us 2 to 3 weeks to actually get them out to all the providers because there's so many on the list. The other thing to know is that we want to make sure that you know we're going to hit saturation at one point. And so the focus more is on you know, getting the surveys out to as many providers throughout the entire county as possible as opposed to saturating every single agency to make sure that every single person that touches that agency does the survey. So that's the focus.
We're planning on hitting the Go Back to School Go event for Vancouver Public Schools, so we'll actually have staff there to help people fill out the survey. The Evergreen FCRCs will have them on hand through the summer, the ones that are open over the summer, and then they'll ramp up at the beginning of the school year. Lydia's working with the Back to School event out in Battleground, so we'll have them out there. We're going to have every homeless school liaison. There's 11, I think, total. That will also have them. So we really are trying to get as far and wide with the survey as we possibly can.
So, did you put them in the Family Resource Center in Washougal?
They will be. I'm working with a couple of different Washougal agencies to make sure that they're all still out there too.
And within the schools, that's probably the best way to do it because we can't identify free and reduced versus non-free and reduced. So it would be difficult to send it out to the entire student population, I think.
Yeah, but the family said
right.
it's freestanding in the
right.
schools out there,
exactly.
so it's,
exactly.
it's you know, 99% lower.
Right. To getting it out to the homeless liaisons and to the FCRCs, I think, is a good way to handle it.
Okay, any other discussion about that? Should we move on to our legislative update? Kate and Michael? Anyone?
Well, I'm going to deflect to somebody that's here that can speak much more intelligently.
Came in for two presentations.
Does everyone know Andy and Olivia?
Hi, Andy Silver with the Council for the Homeless.
And Olivia Resnick with Council for the Homeless.
Is it the levy update?
Yes, levy update.
Yes. Let me have another copy. The City of Vancouver unanimously voted to put the affordable housing levy on the November ballot, which is great. So November 8th will be the vote. It needs a simple majority of voters to pass. Some just quick details in case you're interested. It would raise $6 million a year for 7 years, so $42 million total. All of that money would be spent on housing that's affordable to people both between 0 and 50% of the area median income. So for example, for a family of four, that would be between 0 and I think $35,000 around there. There's been a campaign formed to help pass the vote. It's called Bring Vancouver Home. You can check it out at bringvancouverhome.com or on Facebook. The heart of the campaign is going to be door knocking and sort of one-on-one communication, although there will be community forums as well. So lots of volunteers are needed for door knocking, for helping put up signs, for different office activities if people are not as inclined to do the one-on-one engagement. And you can sign up for volunteer opportunities on the website, and just help spread the word. And you can sign up for the email listserv too.
Thank you, Randy.
So that funding is for construction and maintenance?
It's for, it could go for construction, acquisition, it could go for preservation, rental assistance, supportive services. It wouldn't be long-term maintenance. Like if a nonprofit or a for-profit was gonna develop a project, you would pencil that into your numbers so that you to figure out how much equity you needed and how much rent you needed to make it work, if that makes sense.
Think about that, the Columbia River condos. You know, what's a good concept initially? It's the ongoing sustainability that gets to be the issue.
And that's where preservation could come in.
Yeah.
So if
okay.
Yeah.
So the city will essentially, what we're talking about is running it through our CDBG review process. So it would be a competitive application process for organizations to present their ideas, and we would be looking for where we felt the highest impact could be made for that committee. Mm-hmm. Correct?
That's correct.
Makes sense. Okay. Makes sense to me. Excellent. Any other legislative update? What's going on at the state level, Kate?
Well, as you well know, we're not in the middle of a legislative session right now. We are, though. I know many of the advocacy agencies, particularly at the state level and the federal level, are creating their advocacy agendas. And so if there's a topic, a focus that you are most passionate about, I certainly recommend that you reach out to a state advocacy agency or federal advocacy agency and share with them what type of policy recommendations you have or rule changes you would like to see, because now is the time. The Washington Low-Income Housing Alliance is in the middle of creating their policy agenda for the 2017 legislative session. I know that one of their main focuses is on either getting rid of or moving forward the sunset on the document recording fees, which is the primary funding source that this board oversees. Currently, about $30 of the current $48 of the document recording fee is going to sunset in 2019. And so the majority of those funds will go away if something is not changed. And so the Alliance, their focus is really on changing that. And hoping to either push out that sunset or get rid of it. Of course, it's going to be a divisive session. I think there are many priorities, the McCleary decision being number one, I believe. The state is in a real challenge to meet the court's requirement of fully funding education. And so the challenge there is, can it be done without affecting the social services? It'll be interesting to see how that comes about. The legislative session starts January 9th, and so it's not too far away, and it's going to be a long session, so it's going to go for a little over 100 days. But there is much to be done. The other kind of stance I know the Alliance is taking is more defensive. There's a lot of focus right now on affordable housing and homelessness, but in many ways it's around making systems more accountable and requiring additional reports and movement toward outcomes, which is always a very good thing. The challenge is that it also requires much more staff time, more data collection, more analysis, and those requirements rarely come with additional funding. And so I think all advocates are just paying attention as to what that might look like and then trying to educate the lawmakers to make sure they're aware of what effects their policies may have in the future. So regarding states or even federal legislative sessions or policies, feel free to reach out to myself or Michael or Rebecca.
And we'd be glad to share with you additional bills or advocacy policy changes that we're following that you might be interested in because it aligns well with your passions or your focus.
I'll just add, first of all, Kate is spot on with everything she just described. I really emphasize document reporting fees as at the state level, an upcoming issue that in terms of advocacy, this board should be heavily interested in. You know, CSPG funding is great, but it's about $400,000 that comes to the county. It pales in comparison in terms of the scale that goes to programs that address poverty and programs that address the homeless continuum of care in Clark County and Vancouver. It just pales compared to document reporting fees, which is upwards above $2 million. So if that got slashed by 40 to 60%, if those document reporting fees sunset, it would be catastrophic to the human services that both address poverty and the homeless continuum of care, like in this area. It just would. So in terms of where you want to focus some advocacy efforts, that's an important one. And just as a federal update, there really isn't a whole lot to update right now. I even went back this morning and looked at the NCAF emails from David Bradley, and they pretty much stopped in March with the presidential election. But the advocacy issues that are going to be happening over the next year and a half from the community action community have really not changed. And it's going to be weatherization funding, which so far has been mostly flat funded. There's been a slight increase at the federal level, but mostly flat. Community services block grant reauthorization, which is kind of like the mission of NCAF to get done. Investment in the National Housing Trust Fund, getting that renewed, and preservation and expansion of the low-income housing tax credit. And Senator Cantwell is being proactive in that area. So, so those are just issues to be aware as they form up over the next year.
Excellent. Thank you, Michael. Thanks, Kate. Thanks, everybody. Any other legislative updates? Anybody want to share anything? All right. Rebecca, do you want to talk about our outcomes report?
Yes. So I apologize if this printed out so small, so I know it's a little hard to read. This is our first quarter report for this year, so this incorporates all of the new programs that we are funding as of the last RFA. There's a couple of programs that are brand new, so they take a little longer to get up and going, so the numbers are a little bit low for a couple of programs. But overall, we really hadn't seen any issues. We're not worried about any programs at this point as far as what their funding level is or what their outcomes look like. We know that they will start serving more populations. One of those programs is Partners in Careers Career Academy. They have finished their first, I think they just finished their first set of 5 workshops for that program. So they'll definitely report it within their second quarter report when we bring that at the next meeting. But everybody seems to be moving full speed ahead, getting out services and reporting back to us.
So, Impact Northwest?
It's a brand new. So, previously they were funded for a prevention program, and now they're receiving both rapid rehousing and permanent supportive housing. So, those are both brand new programs.
Can you just tell me what CHG and ESG stand for again?
CHG is the Consolidated Homeless Grant.
And I'll share that CHG is the state's portion of the document recording fees. And so a portion of every document that's recorded, that fee, 60% basically stays locally and 40% goes up to the state. And so it's that 40% that's reallocated to the local level through the Consolidated Homeless Grant.
And then ESG is the Emergency Solutions Grant. and that's federal funding.
So isn't there some county funding that from some filing fees?
So those are all other than the community funds, the bulk of this.
Okay.
So that's where those lie. CHG and ESG have slightly different grant periods.
Okay.
And so we separated those out because of that. So it'd be a little bit easier to understand the report. That can get a little complicated.
Mm-hmm. And CHG again was?
Consolidated Homeless Grant.
Rebecca, on Second Step Housing, their goal is to have 20 families served and 15 families exiting their permanent housing. And it looks like right now they have one. We're halfway through the year. Do we know where we're kind of, what's that looking like?
Second Step Housing tends to be a longer program. It's transitional housing, and so it will take longer for families to enter and exit that program. And then they also will be reporting on households that were already in their program from previous funding. But yeah, it just takes time. Everybody exits at their own pace through that program. It's different than rapid rehousing. Rapid rehousing is a light touch where we don't guarantee they're going to be receiving funding the next month. Transitional housing tends to be a little bit longer of a program. And they are serving a little bit more higher barrier households.
Any other questions, discussion?
What?
Oh.
You know, we really just ends. Lots of ends. We like ends. Thank you. And I'll spell out the CHG again.
Well, I just wanted to share it to you quickly. It looks like Lentwell, I mean, their goal was to serve 100 and they've already served 98, so they are really.
Is there
still a wait for
Microsoft
classes?
There is, yes. And we're fortunate in that Share has really ramped up their offerings of Rentwell. And one of the reasons that they have is because they've been able to leverage the funding that we provide, which is really for administration of the Rentwell curriculum, which is a tenant education curriculum. And receive additional grants from other entities to teach the class.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just means that there's more people that they're offering the class to, and that's why the numbers are where they are. But the fact is that Rentwell is really an excellent tool to help people, you know, learn how to be good tenants and to understand what landlords expect of them. And if we've heard anything from landlords, is that, you know, they often have to provide that knowledge to their tenants because their tenants just don't understand what the landlord's expecting them. So Rentwell helps provide that. And then it also comes with a landlord guarantee, too, which recently actually has been becoming much more popular among landlords, which I also think is because the rental market is loosening up just a little.
Any other discussion? We'll move right on to Andy and Olivia to talk about the housing solutions.
I'm here mostly just to smile, so I'm going to turn it over to you.
I should have told you, actually, the projector doesn't look like we have one, and that's fine.
Oh!
Because I have some printouts.
Janet, do you think that we'd be able to get a projector set up quickly? It'd probably take a few minutes, probably longer than your...
Probably just better to...
Yeah.
I guess.
Don't worry, I came prepared.
Thank you.
I don't want it in my house. That's the bottom line.
Most of the documents I got out at the reminder email.
Hi, good morning. As I said earlier, my name is Olivia Resnick, and I'm the director of the Housing Solutions Center. And Rebecca asked that we come here today to talk to you about the Housing Solutions Center and the process that folks have to go through to gain access to programs in the community. So, as many of you already know, that the Housing Solutions Center is the entry point to housing programs within Clark County. We work with 6 different housing program agencies and 40 different programs. And generally, our overall goal is to assess and find the best possible fit for programs to ensure long-term housing stability for our clients. So if we look at the next slide, what is the agency placement process? This is just a quick general overview of our placement process, which at times can be incredibly complex behind the scenes, at least. So what is important for people to know is that we have a call center, which is where generally people access our services, that folks go through an assessment process, which may be over the phone or in process, over the phone or in person, and that we also do program placement, so we collaborate with the housing agencies and coordinate for the placements. So one question that's asked of us a lot is, how are folks referred to us? So, you know, we collaborate with a number of outside agencies, whether that be housing agencies, community agencies, the community at large, outreach, and that's where our referrals come, and they filter into our housing hotline. So when you come across folks in need, you know, a lot of times the question is exactly how do you access services, have them call the housing hotline. And what generally the call center does is they evaluate what the needs of the clients are and determine the next steps. So on the next slide, call center evaluates clients' needs and next steps. Through a number of questions, the call center determines if they are in need of a housing assessment, if they're in need of emergency shelter, if they need a motel voucher, or if they need prevention programming. How is the assessment process completed, and what are some of the possible placements? So a lot of times we think about assessment as the formal assessment for housing placement. However, we do assessments throughout the whole process. So even when people call into the call center and they're trying to access emergency shelter or perhaps a motel voucher, the call center is determining what their need is and how vulnerable they are to die in the streets. The majority of our shelters will place based on that vulnerability. So we're looking at the age of children, family composition, age of head of household, medical needs, and mental health needs when placing into shelter.
The most vulnerable.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Not the other way. Is that what you're? Is that
okay. No, it's a key theme.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Everything is based on vulnerability at this point. Yeah. So the most vulnerable. Is usually who is able to access programs first. And as far as motel vouchers, when we have those that are incredibly vulnerable, we may give them a motel voucher so they can safely stay in a motel. And that would be either there's no shelter availability or they have special needs. So in the past month, we've had a family with a child with Kawasaki's. They are unable to stay in shelter based on the vulnerability of the child, so we were able to use a motel voucher until they were placed in program. We also had a client that's in need of a lung transplant that has a ton of medical equipment and obviously is vulnerable to infection and unable to stay at the men's shelter, so we were able to use a motel voucher so he could be safe from the elements. We also, just a side note, we work with police as well, who are also able to get motel vouchers. Something important to note with process is that as far as placement within shelters, that's definitely a priority, but something else that Hall Center tries to work on is navigating college to alternative solutions to shelter, because obviously we only have so much capacity within our shelters, and a lot of times clients are calling in crisis and they haven't actually had the opportunity to brainstorm other places they could stay, like friends or family. The prevention assessment process. So prevention is for folks that are at risk of losing their housing, whether they're doubled up, staying with friends or family, if they're paying for their own motel, or they're in fear of eviction. And so the call center will use Commerce's targeted prevention tool to assess whether or not these folks qualify for prevention. And then they're placed into Share Prevention Impact Northwest when there's availability. We get upwards of 20 calls a day for prevention programming through the call center, and we have extremely limited availability for program. So the call center tries really hard to work with those calling in to find alternative solutions, whether it's talking to them about staying for a longer time with their friends or family, assisting even to talking to the friends and family, to negotiate that for the client. Also, talking the client through the eviction, because sometimes they'll call in saying they need prevention, but maybe they actually have more time than they thought within their rental. So talking to them about how they can talk to their landlord to extend their time. So we have pretty good success with that. Because that, I think, as far as last quarter, we only had 3 placements within prevention.
So there's a difference between prevention assessment and the earlier regular assessment, separate programs?
Yes. So prevention is for those that are at risk of losing housing. So, and that would include people that have lost housing and are staying with friends and family.
But all need housing, you call it.
That all need housing and call in.
Right.
Generally, unless they just need resources and they've been directed to us, but majority of them do need some permanent housing. and obviously, we conduct housing assessments, and we utilize 2 tools for our housing assessments, the VIS, the DAD, and the VAT, which assess folks based on vulnerability, and then folks are placed into program based on that vulnerability score. So those with the highest acuity are placed first into program. We place into permanent supportive housing and housing first programs, which are non-time limited, so folks can expect to stay within those programs indefinitely. Unless they come to there's a point where they are no longer in need of housing supports. And we also place in a rapid rehousing, which Rebecca touched on, and transitional. And then we also serve folks in our own diversion program. So when folks receive an assessment, these are the 3 categories they may fall into. And if they score low, then they're deemed ineligible for traditional housing programs, and so they would not be referred to outside agencies. So to assist those that fall into the categories, we actually, like I said, assist them with diversion, which is the next slide. And so in a number of communities, when folks score really low on the assessment, it's kind of they're just left to their own and are expected to navigate the system and figure out how to find housing. However, we didn't feel like that would work for our clients, particularly because of the housing market at this time and the landlord-tenant laws in the community. So even though folks that score low have few vulnerabilities and barriers, like they may be employed, this may be the first time they're homeless, they have minimal mental health concerns and medical concerns, they are still challenged with navigating the complex system within our community. particularly challenged because living in homelessness is expensive, and so they are challenged with paying off their debt, which is probably the primary barrier for these folks in securing housing. So we assist them with debt repayment, connecting them to the Housing Resource Center so they can assist with that process. We assist financially with moving costs and deposits. We go beyond just the financial piece. We also assist them with linking to wraparound services, whether that's employment or mental health services or medical services. And we also, our primary goal is obviously long-term housing stability. So even though these folks are less vulnerable, they still have a number of challenges that need to be navigated. And so we really want to prepare them for long-term success. So, you know, we are sharing with them, we're doing crisis planning with them and budgeting and also goal setting. And obviously we also do housing navigation. So we have relationships with landlords that we can easily transition folks into permanent housing. So, and at this point, our diversion is funded by private dollars, and we also have United Way funding and Community Foundation. And recently, we have a building change grant, and so we're excited about this because now we're able to have one person dedicated to diversion. And prior to this grant, everyone was in charge of doing assessments and placements and also providing the support. So that's what we do in a nutshell.
Can you talk about why coordinated assessment is a best practice? Why you see this one?
So I guess looking at the history of housing supports and how communities place folks into programs, one of the challenges was prior to coordinated assessment, folks would have to go from agency to agency and get on a number of wait lists, which was incredibly challenging to navigate. And they would have to keep up with every agency, and a lot of times folks got lost in the system and therefore never received the housing supports that they needed. So with coordinated assessment and entry, having just one access point just eases the process for them, and everyone is assessed with a best practice tool, which means that we have a pretty good chance of stabilizing them long-term in housing. Instead of when we had a system that when folks went to the housing agencies, it didn't necessarily mean we were getting an assessment that would place them in the correct programming.
Just throw in one more thing there. Before there was coordinated assessment and every program was doing their own, it made no sense for a program to take applications when they didn't have openings. So we had no idea what the actual need in the community was or if our resources were allocated in the correct manner, because if you happened to become homeless on a day that nobody had openings, you just call a bunch of people and we'd never record your information or anything. So the coordinated assessment process, now we see a fuller picture of what's happening in the community, where the needs are, and then people like this board can take that information and use it when they're allocating resources.
Yeah, so right now we have 748 folks waiting for our housing program. And I can just tell you 150 of those are waiting for permanent supportive housing or Housing First. So we have access to all that data, and that's just the click of a button now for us to be able to say this is what our community looks like. And obviously, you know, dictating what our needs are for housing.
Can you talk more specifically about the use of knowing how vulnerable someone is and how that's utilized when placing someone into a program?
Say that one more time.
How vulnerability is taken into account when you're referring to programs?
So our assessment tools are based on vulnerability. So when we go through the assessment, we're looking at how vulnerable folks are to die on the street, which usually relates to what their medical need is, what their psychological need is, old they are, what, you know, if they're taken advantage of on the street, et cetera. And so what happens is you get a score, and then you're placed based on that score. The most vulnerable folks will go into permanent supportive housing, and the most vulnerable of the vulnerable go to the Housing First programs like Lincoln Place, and a number of other agencies run those programs as well.
I feel like I'm the old historian in the room. So the only other thing I would add is that, so there's a difference between eligibility and this assessment that Olivia's talking, right? So eligibility is, you know, you can't be served by this program unless A, B, and C are true. So maybe you have to be, for permanent supportive housing, chronically homeless, with a specific definition. It used to be, when programs opened up their applications, they would just do the eligibility check. So if you were eligible and we had an opening and you were the first person in line, we would serve you. Now we do both eligibility and the vulnerability assessments that Olivia are describing, which ensures that not just are we getting people who are eligible, but we're getting the people who are most in need for that particular housing intervention.
I'd like to add something into that as well, and you know, more addressed to the board. One criticism I hear every now and then about coordinated entry and the Housing Solutions Center specifically is really a misunderstanding, and that is that that approach is really good for serving chronically homeless, but there's a bunch of subset population that doesn't get served, you know, in our community because of that. And what is misunderstood with that criticism is what is driving who is served is this vulnerability assessment, which is it's not a Housing Solutions Center thing. It's a continuum of care system approach to triage and prioritize who's going to receive the service first, just like Andy said about eligibility and assessment. And that is a best practice. And the reason it's the best practice, you know, on the ethical side, you want to serve those who are, you know, in the most immediate need and vulnerable first. But on the fiscal responsibility side, the most vulnerable have been the most expensive to the community. So, you know, whether you're talking about use of emergency services and first responders, or you're talking about incarceration and law enforcement intervention, or you're talking about behavioral acting out impact to business, the most vulnerable is where you can make the best impact in terms of resource efficiency. So, you know, what that looks like to many people that may not be as involved in the system is, okay, you know, Lincoln Place is going to chronically homeless, and then there's some, you know, but you know, there's a big discussion on chronically homeless and focus. And then if you have other individuals and households that aren't quite in that level of crisis, they just don't get served. And that's inaccurate. You know, they, first of all, you know, they are going through assessment. They are being helped to, you know, whether it's through diversion or to connect to resources that may be effective to them. And they are, you know, they are being tracked and put in the queue to receive services, which they wouldn't have before the existence of coordinated assessment and coordinated entry. You know, so, you know, it's just for your awareness. Yeah, you know, that's not a Housing Solutions Center thing, that's a system thing. Sorry.
Well, I'd just like to add too, being another old person and seeing it for a few years. I've been the homeless liaison for Battleground Schools for about 12 years. And before Housing Solutions Center, I had families who would spend their very limited resources or no resources on making the phone calls, getting rides to different programs, chasing their tail, truly. And now, yes, there's still a wait, but they're able to call one place. They're already in the system, in the loop. They need to check back in periodically, with, you know, whatever the arrangement is with the Housing Solutions Center, whether it's weekly or daily or whatever it is. But it certainly streamlines the process for our families and helps them to, I think most importantly, feel like they're not forgotten and that they're just swept aside. And I think that's a really important kind of a side benefit of the Housing Solutions Center and having it there.
It's also the case that they don't have to tell a story.
Yeah, you
embellish it to make it sound worse. They ought to do that 10 times
yeah.
a day, which is traumatizing.
You bet.
So.
You bet. I do have a question, though. How do folks at the Housing Solutions Center, when they're answering the phone, how do they, I know they determine it based on the VAC scores and all of that, but what I'm thinking of specifically is on the mental health side of it. I've worked with families that don't have a mental health diagnosis, but they're not able to navigate the system. They're not able to fully function, I guess, is the most appropriate way to put it. How are staff trained on how to interpret what they're hearing on the other end of the phone? And do they only, like for the mental health side of things, do they only score someone based on whether they have a diagnosis or how they're reacting, how they're speaking, those types of things?
So as far as the staff's training, they get trained on a number of mental health diagnoses and presentation, and there's several staff that have a more clinical background or are able to assist in navigating those clients. As far as the assessment goes, it's not such a subjective assessment where folks have to sit back and really analyze the presentation mm-hmm. to an extreme. The tool actually does it itself. And ask very clear, concise yes or no questions to determine what their need is. If, for instance, we have a client that's paranoid and does not answer the questions accurately, usually, more than likely, we can tell that, and therefore we will work through the assessment using our own experience with the client. And then as far as when they're calling in the call center, not a lot of times, but there's a number of times when we have folks that find the whole process challenging. So our goal is to meet the client where they're at. So whatever that means, whether or not we have to go out in the community to find the client, to have a care worker bring them in. And we have folks that come in off the street that have serious mental health, and it's even challenging to pick up the phone to call the call center. So we just come out and work with them one-on-one. And we're also working on increasing access to the assessment so that folks don't need to navigate a complex system. And so we have outreach workers trained to do the assessment, and we obviously provide the quality assurance piece. And we also are training Janice youth at this time. Their youth have easy access to the assessment, and we're hoping to expand that, and that's definitely a best practice too.
Can you talk about other access points? You mentioned outreach. What would that look like? Maybe other systems of care that you've partnered with?
Yeah. So at this point, for our formal housing assessment, Janice will be trained to do that, and we also have outsiders, Adam from Outsiders End, that's able to go around, and when they come in contact with someone in homelessness, they're able to do an assessment on the spot. But we also have, aside from our primary assessment, we have the vulnerability assessment tool, the VAT, which we use for our most vulnerable. And we have a number of folks within the community that are trained in the tool. So PATH is trained on a tool from CSN. We have Share Outreach teams trained in it. We have Lifeline Sobering Center trained in the tool. So that tool is specifically used for our most chronic and vulnerable, meaning that they've been homeless for at least a year consecutively, or they've had a number of episodes in the last 3 years that equal a year, and they also have a disability. So a lot of times that's pretty subjective when they encounter clients that they will assess. But it at least gives access to a number of people that may not have been able to come through our formal process.
We have a great partnership with the Clark County Jail, too, where we're able to assess people before they're discharged.
Yeah, and we also do phone assessments as needed with system of care, so jail reentry and the sobering center specifically. And our hope is to build a relationship with our hospital. We have some contacts at the hospitals, and we're hoping really to get the social workers trained on the tool in the emergency room.
When does Freedom's Path open?
August.
August?
No, I think it's very early August.
And that will be how many beds?
30
or 50.
40.
It's 50, it's 49, I think. But 40 that are targeted for the continuum care.
So it takes a little bit.
Yeah, and we're still trying to learn a couple things about Freedom's Path. So originally that was supposed to be reserved for Clark County veterans, and I know that has shifted to prioritizing Clark County veterans because apparently there aren't enough homeless Clark County veterans that meet the eligibility criteria, so they're also looking at the Portland area. I do not know how many. I think they have 30 people or 32, something like that, identified already for Freedom's Path, and I don't know what the proportion is. Is that how you understand it as well?
Yeah, because unfortunately, they used, there's VASH, Veterans Support, like whatever, what is VASH for? Who knows? They used a funding source that severely limits who as a homeless veteran can access, but then they have tenant screening criteria, which have been relaxed through efforts from the county and the city, but they have screening criteria that then prevent some of those people from getting in. So you're looking at they're serving sort of just a little slice of the...
But yet, they don't have enough veterans that meet that criteria in Clark County.
Well, they'll have enough, metro-wide, but not in Clark County, no. Not even close.
But I assume that they only serve those with honorable discharges, so that's one of the challenges, because a number of our veterans that are homeless don't necessarily have dishonorable, but they may have other than honorable discharge.
And quite frankly, we knew that. I mean, when they were planning it, they called and asked, and we told them we wouldn't be able to serve. It was not a surprise to us, at least.
But again, it's great that we have that data, and we wouldn't have that without the Housing Solutions Center. Any other questions for Olivia and Andy? Great. Thank you guys very
Thanks.
Much for
Appreciate
coming
it.
And sharing. Appreciate it. All right. Any public comments from anyone? I think we're good.
So I wanted to make sure that people knew about a podcast series, The Uncertain Hour, that Marketplace produced 6 episodes. Its focus this season was on the change in welfare. So it's been 20 years since welfare reform was signed into law, and they give a very interesting dive into what welfare is today. Look for The Uncertain Hour.
Great. Thank you. Anyone else?
I just wanted to mention that as you guys have been notified, Jessie is no longer part of the Community Action Advisory Board. She's moved over to Portland to pursue employment opportunity. And so that position has been open. It's there was a news release back on June 30th that was sent out. You also have it in the packet today. It's been spread out far and wide. I've not had any phone calls regarding that. We are looking for somebody that would be a low-income representative that lives basically on the east side of the county. So if you know anyone that meets that criteria, please have them give me a call. We have the new democratic selection process we have to go through, which adds another hurdle. But we are more than happy to work with them to make sure that that happens and make sure we can get it as easily.
Rebecca?
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. Is there an income limit if somebody's working but they're low income?
There's not a specific income limit that we've designated. Our board tends to serve people who are under 200% of the federal poverty level, so if we needed to set a hard line, that's where I would be.
Okay. So if they qualify for lowering their health insurance, that might or might not?
They should qualify, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Great. Thank you, everybody. So next meeting is not until September 13th, and we will see you all then. Thank you.
Hey.